Welcome to another Network Computing Security Channel podcast. I'm Curtis Franklin, your host for these podcasts. And today we've got a really neat interview looking at security from a different angle than the one most of us use to examine security. You know, a lot of us spend a great deal of time thinking about security from the user perspective. How difficult are we going to make it for users to access the systems and the data that we protect? Or we look at it from the technology perspective. What sorts of tools can we put in place to protect our networks, our systems, our data? But we don't spend a great deal of time thinking about security from the economic point of view. You know, there are some very basic economic equations that all of us use when we're talking about security. We tend to weigh the value of a breakdown in our security. How much would be lost if data was taken out of our systems or if access to those systems was denied to us by an attacker versus the cost of preventing that attack? And this is a calculus that we're always going through as we try to decide whether to implement a given bit of security. Well, our guest today, John Perante, has looked at this question, the economic question, from a little more advanced point of view. And I think that even for those of us who are down in the trenches, who aren't at the C-level corner office, it's very important to think about the economic impact and the economic benefit of what we're doing in security. Now, John comes at this from a position of a lot of experience. He is a certified information systems auditor. He has his CISM, his CISSP, his ISSAP, ISSMP. The man has taken and passed a bunch of tests. He's good at what he does, and he's been doing it for a long time. A lot of people tend to pay a lot of money to hear his opinions on the issues of the economic calculations that need to take place while we're considering security. I thought this was a fascinating conversation that we had. Hope you find it that way too. Here's John Perante, and at the end we'll be back to talk about what's coming up in some future podcasts. Most people, when they think of security, there is a foundation economic formula, and that's where you weigh the cost of the security versus the potential cost of a loss. But I understand you have been doing work on refining that and looking at the economics from a different direction. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Traditionally, information security has been a very technically focused, incident-driven solution or concept. And in that kind of foray, we waited for things to happen. We waited as a community for an incident or an activity or an event to take place, which then springs our capabilities into action. And this has been effective to some degree, but a very costly and very tenuous exercise for most organizations. So what we're trying to do is help people understand what are the things we can do from a forward-thinking perspective. So we're trying to be a business-focused and proactive version versus that incident-driven play. And in doing so, what we're also saying is it's important to measure and have metrics along your activities so you can show improvement over time and have continuous improvement capabilities. So one of the ways that we accomplish this is by introducing concepts such as threat and vulnerability management. And what this concept essentially says is let's look at a business process and do a threat analysis activity of this process. And then look at the possibilities. What are the possibilities of how an adversary could take advantage of this situation or business process? What are their motivations? What are the capabilities they would require? When would they do these things? Why would they do these things? And do they really have the tools and techniques to do so easily available to them? The next piece of that puzzle becomes to say, now that I understand how somebody could do something to me, what is the business impact if they do something like this to me? And along with the business impact, once we've assessed that, then we look at the likelihood. Because what we have to remember is there's a lot of people who can do a lot of bad things. There are a lot of people who can take actions that are malicious in nature and cause severe amounts of damage. But there has to be motivation. There has to be some trigger or capability that says to them, this is something that I'm going to do, and I'm going to deal with the consequences of my actions. So very quickly, by doing so, we now can identify the possibilities of how something could happen to us, the business impact if something does happen to us, and the likelihood of doing so. Then we swing it over now to what we call our vulnerability management phase. And our vulnerability management phase essentially says, the threat analysis has told us for this business process, here is where we're at risk. And we've identified the high probable, high likelihood, and high impact pieces using the threat analysis. We now can build control frameworks, which are really just tools, techniques, concepts, and procedures that allow us to mitigate the threats that we've identified. And these controls can be measured for their effectiveness on a regular basis. So by doing so, we've now given ourselves the thought of looking forward instead of waiting for the bad thing to happen to us. We've identified how it could happen. We've looked at the techniques that would be required. And now we can build proactive vulnerability management concepts that help protect us from those potential bad things. By doing so, now we can also demonstrate to our management teams and to our shareholders and to anybody who looks at us from a responsibility of financially and doing the right things, say we're doing things in a more business-centric, proactive way because we're showing value in what we're doing through our measures and our metrics and our controls, as well as being a proactive perspective allows us to reduce our incident response costs. So we're no longer having to deploy heroic resources and heroic activities in order to counteract the virus or the worm or the attacker that's attacking our environments.
Okay. Well, reducing cost is critical regardless of where in the process and which business process you attach that to. But in talking to most business managers, I get the sense that they see security as one of those areas where no matter what you do to it, no matter how you analyze it, no matter how you mitigate the threats or analyze and whether you're proactive or reactive, you're still dealing with pure cost. Is that what you're finding as you're doing these analyses?
What I find is the technically driven analyses or the technically driven organizations do view this still as pure cost because their typical answer to the problem is to buy technology or make new investments. What they're not typically doing is saying, how can I use this new level of security as an advantage? How can I use this in marketing purposes with my clients to make them feel better about doing business with me? How can I work with my vendors and partners in such a way that I'm actually assisting our business processes to be more efficient, which then allow them to be have a better return on investment or be more highly profitable than they were before? What I can do to put in place this level of comfort and safety within my business so people don't have to think about security. Right now, we do spend a lot of cost in our day-to-day efforts just on people thinking about security and doing things to protect themselves because there are concerns. If we can reach a level of transparency in security where our customers and our clients or our users, whatever the case may be, feel as though they are secure, they can do their work more effectively without having to think about these things, then we achieve return on investment very quickly in any investment we do in security. Now, we always have to remember security is always a moving target. So even with all the threat analysis activities and the vulnerability management activities, I typically still give that 80-20 rule. You can't think about everything. You can't be ahead of every threat. You can't be ahead of every vulnerability. It's not ever going to be something that's a reliable way of solving the problem. What you can do, though, is you can get ahead of the problem in most cases.
Okay.
By advertising that, you actually can gain benefit of drawing customers and drawing potential users and other people into your environment because they look as though that you're doing the right things that make you more attracted to do business with.
All right. Well, now, let me ask a question. You talk about doing an analysis of the business processes from a security point of view. I know that we have had over the past 20 years lots of different reasons for doing business process analysis. Are you finding any cases where analyzing from a security standpoint allows for some improvement in the business process from a business standpoint?
That's a great question, and absolutely. Because by doing security type analyses on business processes, you tend to be taking a view to find out how can you take advantage of the weakness of the processes. Where are the processes not really effective? Where do they have challenges? So thinking in that way, if you're thinking in the threat analysis process as an adversary who is going to try to do something in a malicious way, you're going to look for the places that the process is not working as well as it could. You're trying to try and take advantage of those things. So I've had multiple client experiences where we've actually gone through and reviewed not the technological infrastructure, but the information infrastructure associated with their business processes, and found outside of security that they can gain efficiencies in their business processes just by doing certain alignment changes in the way they do their control structures, or doing certain elements of adjustment in the way they even fundamentally approach the business process.
Okay. Well, as you're looking, you know, once you've identified the threats and you began looking at threat mitigation, the perspective of most users, and I think this is reinforced for anyone who has air travel as part of their business or personal life, is that security is necessarily a case of being annoyed right up to the point where you say it's not worth it to be involved. Is that something that is another necessary outcome of the analysis and mitigation that you're doing, or is that a misperception that you're able to get around if you do some analysis and are a bit more proactive about the security issues?
Well, that's a great question. And I think what you've highlighted is probably the greatest failure that we have as information security professionals and security professionals. Because when we don't complement the business process, we hinder the business process. So I think that we have taken this view of information security, or security in general, when you talk about airport security and things like this, and we believe that some way, if we create perceptive drivers of security, or if we do things that will hinder the individual or the business process in the onus of trying to make it more secure, that will make it better. In reality, we have to remember that this is a risk-reward conversation. And every business process, every situation will have a risk-reward scenario associated with it that says, yes, I could do certain things technologically or with security or different pieces, but does it really make sense to do so? Am I hindering the business process so much that it's no longer something that's an effective process to the business or a benefit to the business? And one thing as information security professionals that we have to stop looking at and reviewing is the idea that we have the right to make that decision. See, we don't have the right to tell a business you have to or cannot do something. What our role really needs to be is to provide people with, at this business level, with information and strategy to say, here are the risks if you do so, here are the controls you can put in place to mitigate that risk, and here is the effect on the business process if you implement these controls. Then the business people who are doing the strategy and looking at the risk-reward scenarios beyond the knowledge of the security people can make decisions that say, yes, this is a good idea, or no, it's not.
Okay. Now, let me ask a sort of a forward-looking question out of that. Do you foresee a day when an organization's chief security officer joins the other C-level executives in the decision-making process for the organization, or do you think it will always be better for the organization if the security team led by that chief security officer is separate from the business-making process, or decision-making process?
I think what we're going to see in the maturity of these concepts, we're just going through that first generation of integration of information security as a separate from IT process. I think what you'll find is you're going to see a chief risk officer created, which will be not necessarily a chief security officer or the chief audit officer or any of the other chiefs have been created, but this is the person that's going to sit at those decision-making tables at the C-suite. That's going to say, I understand the risks that are being brought to the table from both a business and technological perspective. My job is to analyze technological risk, information security risk, as well as pure business risk. Should we or should we not invest in this opportunity? Should we or should we not get into this area of the business? And again, their role will be to present to the president and chief executive and the board of directors the perspective of what are the risks from a complete business perspective of getting involved in a certain activity, but not to actually make the decision whether or not it's the right thing to do.
All right. Now, for that chief risk officer, the way you see the role evolving, do you see an MBA or a CISSP being more important?
An MBA, by far. I can tell you my experience has been with working with many CISOs all across the world on a regular basis, that the CISOs that are technically focused or came out of the technical ranks are the ones that tend to fail.
Fascinating.
It's my opinion and view that the most successful CISOs that are in place today are those who have business backgrounds, who have an appreciation of the technology, not the reverse.
That's a fascinating point of view, especially coming from someone in a technology company.
Well, it's a maturation phase. The first generation of CISOs made sense to be technical in nature because we looked at the problem very technically, and certain infrastructure elements needed to be put in place to get to some degree of a baseline of generally accepted best practices for security. But now we're maturing beyond that. Now the business is saying to us, we really need to be able to do business. We need to be able to move on the fear of security that we've created through things like Y2K and 9/11 and other activities that have kind of built this persona of fear, because fear will not let us be successful. So we need the security team to be more complementary than to disabling us from doing business. And a great example of this, if you wouldn't mind me saying, is the idea of the complex long password. This is something that I often speak to people and say that it's a good idea in certain environments, but when you look at the actual effects it has on the business process, we may not be solving the problem we started out trying to solve. The idea being is that long, complex passwords are there to combat a threat that's technological in nature. And a technological CISO or a technological security organization is always going to go in favor of that complex password. What they haven't realized is all the steps it takes to actually carry out that electronic threat. And typically that means that I have to get access to that person or individual's desktop or laptop. I have to get into their file system and run some sort of program that can guess passwords or crack passwords and things like that. What I often say to people today is, we have made that complex password problem so hard for our users that we're incenting the behavior that we didn't want to create. And that is that they're writing them down.
Right.
So if it's a lot easier for me to walk up to that laptop and look at the post-it for the password than to run any of these other programs.
I've known a number of consultants who say that the first thing they do when they walk into an office is pick up the phones and look on the bottom and do the same thing to the keyboards.
That's exactly what I do when I go to teach people these problems. And I respect and love the technology. And I think that you need to look at the way you look at controls, which passwords and long complex passwords are, in alignment to your asset classification strategy that talks about what's sensitive, what's not sensitive, what are my use cases. Because by using these long, complex passwords, we may solve a technological problem, but we're not enabling our users.
I love that example, and I couldn't agree with you more. My favorite example of this problem is my dad, who is in his 70s, still working, and working for a large defense contractor. He has multiple strong passwords that roll every 30 days and cannot be reused, cannot be more than 2-character dictionary lookup. And trying to remember all those is a significant piece of his business responsibility now.
You know, it's funny, too, when you talk about the dictionary lookup, the attackers have gotten smart. In the recent virus outbreaks we've seen that include keyloggers in them, What you actually are now seeing is the attackers are getting that keylog stream, and they're doing reverse dictionary lookups. They're using the dictionary lookups to knock out all the possible dictionary words. So they find the character string that's 6 to 8 characters in length, that's uppercase, lowercase, special character, or number, and then they know they have a high probability that that's a password because it's the only thing not in the dictionary.
Fascinating.
So the problem that we tried to solve there, while it was valiant in effort from a security perspective to use these types of long passwords, and there were technological means of carrying out that through certain tools and capabilities, we've now built ourselves into such a state of fear and complexity that we have a much easier way of compromising that system than even using that technological concept.
Amazing.
What a business-driven CISO is going to do, he's going to look at his world, he's going to say, how can I be both transparent and complementary to the business process?
Right. Right. Well, just a couple more questions. I appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today.
My pleasure.
One of them involves the threats and risks that you're seeing. As you're going around and doing the risk assessment and threat analysis with customers, what are you finding to be the two or three most significant threats they're facing? And part B on this question is, are those the same threats that the companies think they're facing when the process starts?
Well, let me start out by kind of bringing you a couple of thoughts that lead to this, but it's a great question. The real threats that we see out there are more aligned to what is the attacker community and the people who are doing malicious activities, how are they carrying them out? So it's better to understand what's going on in the community, then we can understand the threats to the organizations as a whole on a major state. And probably the most interesting and the most often seen threat that we have today in the technological side of the business processes is patch management scenarios. We have a lot of people who spent a lot of time developing patch management capabilities in order to release and to update systems when patches are released by vendors. One of the things that we have, though, is we have an adversary community who's come together and decided to get a little bit lazy. So traditionally, they would try and find exploits in systems and try and find ways to penetrate systems, and it would take time and effort, and it was really almost like an art. Now we have contests in the underground where when a patch is released by a vendor, there are contests to see how quickly can somebody write an attack against that patch or against what that patch is trying to patch. And what's happening here is the adversary is counting on the fact that they can attack you faster than you can patch your systems.
Okay.
So it's no longer finding a new vulnerability. It's actually taking advantage of the fact that you have good processes like the ITIL processes for patch and change management and things like this that we've all prescribed as good things, but realizing these processes take time to be worked well. For instance, in the patch management scenario, you need time to test patches to make sure they don't cause a derogatory behavior within your environment, that they don't cause more harm than good. So the adversary is counting on the fact that you need that test time. They don't need that test time.
Right.
Right. So we have a window of opportunity that exists between the time a patch is released and the time that the patch management process goes through its very capable and very, very appropriate processes to truly patch all the systems that are out there. So this, what I would say, is probably one of the top things we're seeing today across my customers when we're doing the threat analysis activities. And it's funny because they think that they're covered because they have patch management capabilities in place already. And their first response to me is, John, I spent a lot of money working through the ITIL processes and developing real structured approaches to solving this and to be able to deploy patches well. And they shake their head and they say, yes, but what are you doing before the patch? How are you protecting yourself? What are you doing to deal with the problem before that patch is released or at the point of release of that patch before you actually have it fully deployed? And that's mm-hmm. becoming a real interesting challenge. The other area we're seeing some growth in is the idea of the blended attack scenario. And this is where my clients are very much getting scared and they're kind of worried because this is a new maturity in the attack phase. And what's happening here is now we're starting to see evidence of adversaries using worms with keystroke loggers in them or using an insider to help them get certain pieces of information so they can exploit outside areas using blended scenarios. So the typical idea that I can protect my network and that would solve all my network attacks and I can protect my application and that would solve all my application attacks no longer prevails as a appropriate measure for security or threat mitigation. So what we have now is this challenge that people are looking to say, what can I do? And typically the advice that we give is a layered approach to security. There is no one magic bullet. There is no one tool, technology, or process or procedure that's going to solve the problem. The only way to truly solve the problem is to have a layered approach. Now, to answer your second question, the biggest surprise that people have, especially given our distributed environments of today, is the fact that they don't really know where all their information is.
Right.
I believe that a lot of people look at their information infrastructure from the perspective of a 1970s or 80s approach, which is what I like to call four walls, a mainframe, and a LAN. And the idea being that if I could just control that perimeter in that area and have knowledge of that, then I'm okay. I know where my data is. I know how to protect it. I know what the risks associated with that data are. But I have very few clients who still do business in that way. Typically, we outsource certain activities or business processes. We work with customers and vendors in sharing information. We have data flowing through so many different environments, and we really don't know where the data is.
Right.
And the first step to any threat analysis or risk analysis activity is to know where your assets are. Because if you don't know where they are, you can't protect them. And often enough, I can find customers and clients who can tell me exactly where their servers are, exactly when they purchased it, the operating system, the applications running on those servers, but they can't tell me the information. And at the end of the day, what's really valuable is the information, not the equipment. And that's probably the biggest thing that comes out as the eye-opener to my clients when we start working with them, to say, I don't really care about the technological infrastructure as much as I care about the information infrastructure.
Right.
And that's probably the biggest challenge that my clients have now, is really going through and finding all of that data, understanding where they're storing it, how it's being used, who has access to it. And that becomes the real challenge of today in our distributed world. Does that answer your question?
It absolutely does. And I tell you what, listening to my end of this conversation, I have to admit, I have ideas for questions that would take us to another podcast or two. So I
welcome it. This has been wonderful.
I will look forward to doing this again. I think there are some areas that we haven't talked about, especially once you get into the question of, do you know where your data is? That would be very fertile topics of discussion. So I will look forward to that.
I welcome the opportunity, sir.
John, thank you so very much for spending time with me today, and I will look forward to our next conversation. Well, that was my conversation with John Perante of Unisys. And like I said, I had a lot of fun with that. It's always interesting to me to think about security from a new perspective. And while I'm aware of the economics of security, that's not where I tend to spend my time thinking. Maybe I should. Maybe we all should spend a little bit more time thinking about the cost and benefit of what we're trying to do. Anyway, hope you got a lot out of that. I know I did, and I'm looking forward to my next chance to spend some time talking with John. Now, in upcoming podcasts, we've got a lot of interesting stuff. I've got more great interviews lined up, including coming up in just a week or so, a group interview with members of the Oath Initiative. Now, this is an open access authentication group that is looking at the ways that we authenticate users into our systems and coming up with some, they're loath to use standards for all of their terminology, but truly open standards for making the bits and pieces of an authentication scheme fit properly and work together. I think that's going to be a great podcast for everyone. Now, on some other news fronts, you may have noticed that CMP is starting to do a great deal with podcasts. I'm working with a lot of different people. Please take an opportunity to search out some of the podcasts that CMP is putting together. Head over to the news show to look at that. Information Week. And if you are someone who enjoys rolling up your sleeves and doing some coding, Dr. Dobbs Journal, John Erickson and his crew are doing some great podcasts. Look as well for another Network Computing Security Channel podcast coming soon. We've got some sponsorship for a dynamite new podcast that will be starting within the next couple of weeks. As always, if you have comments or have some ideas about a podcast topic that you would like to hear, please let me know. The email address is cfranklin@cmp.com. Thanks for taking the time to spend with me while you've listened to this. Hope you have a great day or evening, depending on where you are. And we'll look forward to seeing you again next time at Network Computing Security Channel Podcast. This is Curtis Franklin. Goodbye.